Good evening. Several years ago, I shared with you a moment in my life that changed the way I looked at some things. And I want to share it again because I think most of you either forgot it or have never heard of it. So this moment was a special moment. It happened in Memphis, Tennessee. At the end of an evening service one evening, I was walking alongside a former elder of the church there in Memphis. His name was Brother James Bobbitt. He has since passed away. But on that evening, we were walking side by side, and as we stepped outside into the sunset, he looked up and said the words of Psalm 19 and verse 1, which is very simply, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork." The way in which Brother Bobbitt said those words was not just to quote a verse at me. He wasn't simply saying them because he was reminded of something, because of something, a conversation we were having, but rather because he was in that moment wanting to honor God and thank him for the beautiful creation that he was experiencing in that moment. I'll never forget the sky that night. It was pink. The clouds were scattered throughout it, and they were all pink, and of course the sky behind it was blue, and it was a beautiful sight indeed. But I had to ask myself, what is it that brings a man to that moment? To where, off the cuff, in mid-conversation with me, he would stop, look into the skies and lost for the moment, and say in an audible voice the words of Psalm 19 and verse 1. I submit to you that it is because that man desired to honor God and thank him in that moment. Those are the two attributes I want to study tonight: honoring God and thanking him. Two very important ideas that we find all throughout the New Testament, but none so clear in Romans chapter 1, verses 20 and 21. We're very familiar with Romans chapter 1. In general, we tend to focus on the catalog of sin, starting in verse 24 and towards the end of the chapter. We also focus on, of course, many good sermons have been preached on Romans chapter 1 and verse 16, where the Apostle Paul declares very adamantly that he is not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. We know these passages. We're familiar with chapter 1. But I fear sometimes we glaze over verses 20 and 21. And here, I believe, we find a very important element to our Christian life. From the English Standard Version, the Bible reads at Romans chapter 1, verses 20 and 21, the following words: "For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and his divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world and the things that have been made. So they're without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish heart was darkened." This statement here provided for us is one that very obviously focuses on honoring God and thanking him. And tonight, by focusing on three important phrases from this verse, I hope that we can see the importance of honoring God and thanking him and how we can apply that to our daily lives. The phrases I want to focus on are in the first verse, verse 20. I'd like to focus on the two attributes of God that are named here, his eternal power and his divine nature. Second, I'd like to focus on the phrase at the beginning of verse 21 that states that they knew God, and subsequently their actions, that they did not acknowledge him. That is, they did not honor him as God or give him thanks. In the first verse, let's take just a moment to step back from verse 20 and try to organize it in our minds. Verse 20 is one of those verses that translates very difficultly from the original language. The Greek language sometimes is all over the place. And what I mean by that is we in English have phrases that come in a certain order mostly. In Greek, it's not the case. It can be anywhere at any given place, and placement of certain words and certain phrases are for emphasis, not necessarily for understandability. And so that translates very difficult into English, and we get these choppy verses like verse 20. And so what I'd like to do just for a second is look at the essential elements of this verse that make it a complete sentence. Grammatically speaking, those things that are necessary to make it a complete sentence, we'll focus on those so we can get the understanding. And then we'll look at the other phrases that are added in. If you were to look at just the grammatical structure of verse 20 and try to understand what it's getting at its core, you focus on three phrases, the very first one, the middle one, and the last one, at least in the English Standard Version. And it would read as following if you were to just take out those three phrases. It would say something like this: the invisible attributes of God are clearly perceived in the things that have been made. Those are the three elements you need to understand the verse in its basic form. The things of God, the attributes of God, are seen in the created order. That's the idea. But the two phrases added in are added to answer two questions. The first question is this: what attributes are those that are seen in the created order? Well, Paul says, namely, his eternal power and his divine nature. The second question is this: how long have we been able to see those attributes in the created order? Well, since the very beginning, right? Since the creation of the world. Ever since this world existed, ever since the universe existed, we as humanity have been able to see these attributes of God in the created order of things. And that's no surprise to us as Christians. We understand this concept very well. We know that merely standing in the created order, we can see the existence of God. But this idea is also in the text. If you were to go back to Genesis chapters 1 and 2, you would find two creation accounts. And let me be very clear about what I mean by that. I do not mean there are two separate events that are cataloged in chapters 1 and then in chapters 2. Rather, it is two different accounts of the same event. It would be like someone cataloging what is happening here in this moment right now, and somebody focusing on me as opposed to another person focusing on y'all, or even the same person writing two different accounts focusing on y'all and then focusing on me. That's what's going on in chapters 1 and 2 of Genesis. In the creation account, we have two different focuses in chapters 1 and in chapter 2. In chapter 1, we have what you might call a theocentric chapter. It is focused on God and his cosmic order. We see God giving order and structure to a chaotic world. Everything was without order, without structure, and God gives it structure and order. We see that not only in the contents of chapter 1, but even in the way it is organized. We see a very strict order of things in chapter 1. We see after every day this phrase: there was morning and there was evening and there was the first day and the second day and the third day and the fourth day and so on. We see this structure. It is very itemized. And we get from that the idea that structure is brought into the universe by God himself. How is God able to do this? Well, by his eternal power, right? His eternal power sets things in order. We see clues of this idea, of this specific attribute, in the things that are created. Notice God sets himself apart from other gods by not mentioning the sun or moon when he creates the two lights that govern day and night. Why doesn't he say sun and moon? Why isn't Moses inspired to say the word sun and moon? Those words existed in Hebrew by the time Moses was physically writing these things out. Why didn't he name them? Well, he wanted to set himself apart from the other gods of the pagan world, of those idol worshippers. They were those who focused on mostly the sun and the moon. God said, I am not either of those gods. I am the one who created those things. He sets himself apart as an eternal power. He also gives this idea of perpetuation. Notice in the creation of plants and animals that they are all created to reproduce after their own kind. This idea of perpetuation is an eternal idea, in a sense, and gives homage to the eternal God. The one who created those things to be perpetual is, in fact, himself a perpetual being. He exists forever. He is eternal. We see a focus on God in Genesis chapter 1, that he is indeed a being with eternal power, power that gave structure and order to this world in which we exist. We also see, though, in chapter 2, homage to his divine nature. In chapter 2, we shift from a focus on God to a focus on man. In chapter 2, we find what's called an anthropocentric, if you can put that together, anthropocentric chapter, as a chapter focused on man and the things that he does, the things that he is responsible for. And in this chapter, we subtly see the idea that God is not man. God is not animal. God is nothing like anything he has created on this earth. He is altogether different. His nature is different than the nature of the created order. He is divine by nature. He is different in his structure, in who he is, and what makes God. And so we see these two ideas, even in the written word, the written account of the creation itself. We see the eternal power of God, the divine nature of God in Genesis 1 and 2. But of course we know not only in the text do we see these ideas, but as we mentioned just moments ago, we see it all around us. We see the beautiful systems that are in place here on this earth that make us able to live here and now, even in this moment. We have the trees outside that provide us with oxygen, and yet God created us with the capacity to produce carbon dioxide, which the trees need in order to produce more oxygen for us to live. Systems like this surround us on this earth and in this universe, and we know that there is something greater than ourselves on this earth. And it is not only us that knows, but all of humanity understands that there is something incredible that surrounds us. And so, they're without excuse, right? Every person that has existed on this earth has understood that there is something greater than themselves here with them that is governing these systems that are so precise and so exact. And so when we see in Romans chapter 1 and verse 21, this phrase, they knew God, we can understand something very important. Although they may not call him God, they may not, as the verse continues to say, honor him as God, they understand that something incredible surrounds them. Everyone who has walked the face of this earth and taken the time to enjoy the creation, the celestial beings that surround us, all these wonderful things that are around us, we can know that they at some point have acknowledged that something incredible is happening. Even the atheist who rejects God most adamantly would admit that there is something incredible happening in this earth. How do we know this? Well, we know that even scientific principles have been established, such as the anthropic principle, which establishes the fact that everything in the universe works together perfectly in order for us to survive here on this earth. Now, they would say that happened by random chance. We would say it's by God. But the point is that they acknowledge that there is something incredible happening on this earth, in this universe, for us to exist. And that everything has to be exactly right. The sun is exactly where it needs to be for us to exist on this earth. We are tilted at exactly the right angle. In order to exist on this earth. We rotate at the exact speed we need to rotate at. We revolve around the sun the exact way we need to revolve around the sun. On and on the list goes of things that have to be exactly in place for us to exist. And the scientific world acknowledges it. They don't say it's God, but they acknowledge that something special is happening around them. Even the atheist would go as far as to say that something is extremely special about life, because some of them would suggest that even though they reject God, they accept the idea that there were aliens that came to this earth and planted life. And that's how we got life on this earth, is because aliens came in and planted life. They reject God, but they accept aliens. Why? Because they know there is something special going on here on this earth. There is something incredible that they can't explain with the laws of nature happening on this earth. Other scientists, or rather atheists, would go so far as to reject their own principles, their own laws, in order to believe in what they believe in, because something incredible is going on. They would say that even though the laws of science demand that life cannot come from non-life, they would brush that law under the rug and say that something happened to create life in order for the evolutionary cycle to have begun. They acknowledge something incredible about life itself, so much so they are willing to ignore the established laws of science. They would say that even though the laws of thermodynamics claims that something cannot be created out of nothing, even though that is an established law of physics, that you cannot get something from nothing, they would sweep that under the rug as well and say, well, something had to have happened in the Big Bang in order for us to be in existence today. They have faith that something happened to break the laws of nature in order to believe the doctrine that they believe in. Why? Because something incredible is happening around us. All around us, we know that there is a God. Every human on this earth acknowledges something incredible. Though they may not call it God, they know God. They know something incredible, something superior to them is in place here. The difference between them and us is the next verse, right? The next section of the verse. In the middle of verse 20, we see this phrase, actually the second phrase in verse 21, rather, says that although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give him thanks. The sin list we see starting in verse 24 is rooted here. This is the cause. Those who do not acknowledge God, who do not give thanks to God, essentially have set themselves as God, at least in the moment. They have placed themselves in control. They do not want to acknowledge him, but rather acknowledge themselves as a human race or as an individual. And this is where bad decisions are made, right? When we refuse to acknowledge God, when we refuse to thank him for the things that he has done, that can only lead us to make bad decisions. And that's where we get the catalog of sins we find at the end of chapter 1, starting in verse 24. This is the core of this text. In order for us to truly honor God and thank him, we have to acknowledge that he exists. And as we go out into the community and try to help others to believe in God, to acknowledge him and give him thanks, this is where we should start, right? By making sure they really believe that there is a God. And by subsequently showing them the things that he has done for us, by doing this, we will have great success, I believe, in our efforts. But the real focus that I wanted to get to tonight is this. How does this affect us? Well, I think we get the idea of what's going on when we read chapter 2 and verse 1. Read with me the very beginning of chapter 2 and verse 1. Notice the text begins by saying, "And so you are also without excuse, O man." That phrase, "O man," would be very catching to a Jewish convert, that is, one who converted into Christianity out of Judaism. Because that phrase is used all throughout the Old Testament to address the Jewish audience. This is a very Jewish directive. It is directed towards those who are of a Jewish descent. This would be kind of like somebody coming into our area, or maybe not even in our area, but saying, "Hey, you good old boys," right? We would know he's talking to Southerners, mostly. This is the kind of force that this phrase has. "Oh man," here, would signal a Jewish mind and say, "Hey, this is talking about me now." So place yourself in the position of this Jewish reader, this Christian who came out of a Jewish descent reading this text. He reads through chapter 1 and rightly assesses that Paul is talking about the Gentiles, the pagan nations. And man, he is all riled up. He is encouraged by what Paul is saying, right? Yes, you're exactly right, Paul. Those pagans, those idol worshipers out there, they are rotten. They keep doing these horrible things. I can't even think of the things that they're doing. They are so horrible. All these horrible sins that they're committing. You are exactly right, Paul. They are without excuse. They have no reason to be doing the things that they are doing. They are all sinners. But then he gets to chapter 2 and verse 1. And his heart kind of sinks into his stomach, right? Because he sees that phrase, "Oh man, you are without excuse." Why? Jump to the end of verse 1. "Because you're practicing the same things." Paul says, you're judging these Gentiles. You're judging these pagans, but you're doing the same things. And the Jewish convert says, wait a minute, Paul. I'm not doing any of those things that you just listed. I'm not doing any of those things that the pagans are doing out there that are so revolting, that are so ugly to me as a Jew. I would never do those things. How is it that Paul, by divine inspiration here, accuses this Jewish convert, these Jewish converts, of doing the same thing. How is it that that happens? Well, because of the principle we just talked about, right? They were not honoring God or giving him thanks. And by not honoring God truly and giving him thanks, they were doing the exact same thing that those pagans were doing in essence, right? That's the point of the text. That's the force of the text. And the point for us is this. Yes, we honor God. There's no doubt about it. We honor God by obeying his laws, by keeping what he says to do, by fulfilling righteousness, by trying to do the things that God would have us to do. Yes, that is how we honor God in part. But not at the expense of losing our faith in him. I think all too often, we sometimes forget to really believe that he is, that he exists, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. All too often, the things that we do get wrong are not necessarily the sins that we see in Romans chapter 1, verses 24 and following, but rather, we just go through the motions. That's what this text is about. That is what Paul is getting at when he brushes in this introduction in chapter 2 and verse 1. Paul is saying it is not enough to just go through the motions. How do we please God? Hebrews 11, chapter 6. We have to believe that he exists, that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. Sometimes I think we forget to take a moment and honor God, to truly acknowledge him as the one, the only one who has eternal power, as a divine being, one who has divine nature in contrast to us, one who is greater than we are, and truly give him thanks for the blessings that he has given us. We, the rebellious creation, sometimes fail to honor the very God that sacrificed all things for us, that gave himself on a cross to live for us. Tomorrow is Memorial Day, and we honor those who have fought in battle, those who have fallen in battle. We honor those who have fought for our nation, and rightly so. But on a regular basis, it is charged to us as Christians to honor the one who sacrificed all things so that we might live. Created by him, rebelling against him, he still died for us. Honoring God does include obeying him. Doug said well this morning that Jesus said, if you would be my friends, you would keep my commandments. We understand that is part of what we do. But we cannot do those things at the expense of losing our faith. Yes, faith without works is dead, James said so very perfectly. But Paul also said in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, that work without love is also worthless. Do we honor our God? Do we give him thanks? Those are two pillars of our existence as Christians. If we do not honor him correctly, if we do not give him thanks correctly, then we cannot serve him correctly. The warning here in Romans 20 and 21 is not just for the pagans. It's not just for the idol worshippers. It's not just for the Gentiles who are outside of the faith. It is for us as spiritual Israel, Galatians chapter 6 and verse 16. We are called to heed the same warnings, to live a life that honors God, and yet do so while honoring him, acknowledging him as the being that he is, the great being that he is, and giving thanks for all the things that he has done for us. It may be the case that you're here tonight.